Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis.
Welcome back to the Security Perimeter Podcast, Myth-Busting World War II. I'm going to continue the series. It's fun. A lot of people are listening. Still not getting any comments. I don't understand how the one on the bomb did not get at least, like, you know, 100 complaining. Either way, whatever. What can I say? So, in this third one, we're going to deal with the mistaken belief amongst many people out there, not saying you guys, but many people out there, that the Nazis were really, really great military strategists, and what they accomplished was militarily impressive when they do this, and it's completely incorrect. In fact, as I often tell my students, thank God the Nazis were in control. And calling the shots, because if it hadn't been for the Nazis, maybe the German Wehrmacht, the German army, might have actually won the war. There were many, many times throughout the entire war where Hitler fought with the general staff, and many of his military decisions were absolute nonsense and garbage. And I think this... Let's see, this particular World War II myth-busting episode will be divided in three parts. The first one's going to deal with the period leading up to the beginning of the Second World War. The second part of the episode is going to look at the period between 1939 and up until the initiation of the campaign against the Russians in the summer of 1941. And then the third part will look at the mess that Hitler created between 1941 and I guess 1945. But it's important to note that he really wasn't good at what he was claims he was doing. And we'll start with the period before the war. The common claim, or the common belief, the achievement of the Nazis, diplomatically speaking, and a sign of how capable Hitler was as a diplomat, because he was able to practically conquer half of Europe even before the war started. Well, that's not exactly true. And what needs to be looked at to begin with is the context. And the context is that you essentially have four great powers. Well, you have four great powers plus Germany, but those four great powers that are hypothetically supposed to be there to balance the expansionist ambitions of Hitler really aren't doing anything. So Hitler didn't succeed diplomatically. Hitler just did what he wanted to do, and nobody stopped him. That's not a diplomatic success. That's just nobody being there to stop you. I don't know what other way to put it. The French in the 1930s built their Maginot Line, this fortification along the border between France and Germany. And they believed that this fortification would be sufficient to stop any kind of German attack against France. And therefore, France almost was like, I mean, the French were really impacted. This is not I don't want to be too hard on the French, because most of World War I was fought actually on French territory. So, although technically France is a winner in the First World War, I mean, essentially the country was in ruins because of the war. So, the French were reticent, I guess. The political mood in France was that, no way we can fight another war. No way. There was no public, there was no mood for any kind of war. And by building the Maginot Line, the French believed that they could essentially isolate themselves from what Hitler was doing. And because of that, they essentially let him do what he wanted to do in the 1930s. And here I'm talking about, or the annexation of Austria, the conquest of Czechoslovakia, etc., the remilitarization of the Rhineland, which is, I guess, the first thing that we'll discuss in a moment. So France is just not there. Great Britain is there, but they also were severely impacted by the First World War. And they also really don't have a mood for war. And Great Britain adopts a strategy that we've all heard of in the 1930s with Hitler called appeasement, where they tried to essentially satisfy, in a sense, permitting the Germans to kind of do what they were doing in the 1930s by saying that, well, you know, I mean, they are a great power, right? So they're entitled to this and they're entitled to that. And the Versailles Treaty was just way too harsh on them. And, you know, we've got to be a little bit more understanding of Hitler and so forth. So a crazy, crazy, crazy foreign policy on the part of the British. The other great power that I want to mention here that could have, let's say, hypothetically stopped the Germans in the 1930s is the United States. Well, we know that after the First World War, the United States returns to its isolationist kind of foreign policy, where it really doesn't give a crap about what's happening in Europe. And the United States doesn't participate in the League of Nations. The League of Nations, therefore, turns out to be just like a useless piece of whatever. The United States, which potentially was a power that could have confronted Hitler in the 1930s, because they weren't that heavily impacted by the First World War in the way that France and Great Britain were, they essentially decide to ignore what's going on in Europe. Not necessarily tolerate it, so to speak, in the way, or appease it that Great Britain does. Maybe something similar to, maybe almost like kind of the French strategy, where they thought that they were safe from Hitler. I guess the French thought that the Maginot Line would do it for them, and I guess that the Americans at the time thought that the Atlantic would keep them safe. So the United States is a potential balancer to what Hitler is doing, and I'm going to put this with air quotes, diplomatically, in the 1930s, is the United States is simply not there. Finally, the Russians, well, they, you know, they have their revolution, and then they have a civil war in the 20s. The country is essentially trying to put itself together after the revolution and the civil war. Stalin is much more concerned about consolidating his power domestically. You know, the purges, 30 million people were killed by Stalin in these purges, mostly in what we know today to be Ukraine. So there wasn't a mood for war for the Soviet Union either. The Soviet Union also was isolated diplomatically from the international system precisely because of the revolution. Was not a member of the League of Nations, etc. So the government wasn't recognized, let's say, by the other powers. So there was no way, for example, for Great Britain and France to work with the Russians. And what the Soviets ended up doing was, you know what, they kind of worked with the Germans. This is no secret. Well, it was a secret then, maybe an open secret, but it certainly isn't a secret now. We know that starting in the 1920s and escalating in the 1930s, there were German training facilities in Russian territory where the Germans were permitted by the Russians secretly to test equipment, etc., to train for war, to develop some of those blitzkrieg tactics that were used in the beginning of the war. by Guderian and others. So in a weird kind of way, you know, the Germans and the Russians were on an alliance. And I know that Vladimir Putin doesn't like hashtag Vladimir Putin, doesn't want to hear this, but yeah, his damn country was allied with the Russians implicitly in the 20s and the 30s, and then explicitly in 1939 when the Soviet Union and Germany signed a friendship treaty. But there were some secret protocols in that treaty where Russia accepted Germany's annexation, let's say, of half of Poland, and in return the Russians would get kind of the eastern part of Poland. So in this treaty they essentially decided to divide Poland in two. And interestingly enough, and I've mentioned this before in this myth-busting World War II series, it was this treaty, this non-aggression treaty between Russia and, or the Soviet Union and Germany, called the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement, which essentially triggered the Second World War. It was the treaty that essentially gave Hitler permission to invade Poland, knowing, of course, that, or believing, of course, that the French and the British wouldn't do anything about it. So in order to understand these so-called diplomatic successes that Hitler had, well, you need to understand the international context, where you essentially have the great powers who are either essentially don't give a shit about what Hitler's doing, or alternatively, like Great Britain, are kind of even maybe indirectly encouraging Hitler. And then, of course, you have the Russians, who were outright allies of the Nazis. Strangely enough, given the fact that the Nazis were so anti-Slav and anti-communist. So the first so-called diplomatic success that Hitler had was the remilitarization of the Rhineland. And that's, I guess that's what we'll start the story of. The Rhineland is a territory that borders, it's a German territory that borders Belgium and France. And it's pretty critical because it's kind of like the route straight through Belgium to Paris. And after World War I, what the great powers decided to do, the winners, the French insisted on this. In fact, the French wanted to like separate the Rhineland from Germany and make it into like a different country that was kind of a protectorate of France. What the great powers decided to do was to demilitarize the Rhineland. It was a headache, or an embarrassment rather, for Hitler, and German territory, and therefore should be occupied by the German military if Germany so wishes. In fact, when Hitler finally does remilitarize in 1936 the Rhineland, the reaction by Great Britain is that, well, you know, it is actually their territory, so the Versailles Treaty was kind of harsh on them. But remilitarizing the Rhineland in 1936 is kind of the beginning of kind of encouraging Hitler to do whatever the heck he wants to do, because the reaction by the great powers was that they really, in fact, Great Britain said that they didn't really consider it such a severe violation of the Versailles Treaty, which is absolute nonsense. The French reaction was non-existent. The Russians, they couldn't care less, and the Americans couldn't care less either. So explain to me how this is such a great diplomatic success when nobody opposed and one country actually encouraged. In fact, Hitler had given orders to his general staff that if there was any kind of opposition, specifically on the part of the French to the remilitarization, in other words, if the French sent in troops to stop the Germans from remilitarizing the Rhineland as specified by the Versailles Treaty, that the Germans were to withdraw immediately. In other words, Hitler knew that Germany was not in a position to fight a war at that moment. So that essentially means if you think about it, that, a couple of French soldiers crossing over from that Maginot Line into the Rhineland could have stopped Hitler from remilitarizing the Rhineland. And here's the sucky part. If the great powers could have gotten their shit together in 1936, stopped Hitler then, recognizing that this was only the beginning of what Hitler was up to. I mean, all you had to do was read Mein Kampf. It wasn't exactly a secret what his plans were. If they would have stopped Hitler in 1936, we would have had a war. But we would have had a war that would have, very short war. Germany would have been overrun very, very quickly. And 80 million lives could have been saved. So allowing Hitler to remilitarize the Rhineland is not a German diplomatic, or it's not a Nazi diplomatic success. It's just a fuck up number one on the part of the other powers. So Hitler's next big great diplomatic victory, I guess, or alternatively the next chance for the other countries around the world to do something about Hitler. Actually, you know what? It's not the second time. It's actually the third time. Because the first time they could have actually done something was when Hitler came to power and he reintroduced conscription, announced that he was reintroducing compulsory military service, and the reaction on the part of everyone was, pretty much what you would expect. And if the war would have taken place at that point, well, then, maybe there would have been like 8 people. I digress. Going back to the second great diplomatic victory on the part of Hitler was the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria, which took place in 1938. So, Austria, as you know, was a country that was formed with the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire after the end of the First World War, and Austria from like the beginning was pretty much torn between the right and the left. Honestly, all of Europe is kind of torn between the right and the left. Everybody's just fighting each other. In the specific case of Austria, it was the countryside versus Vienna. They used to, Vienna was called Red Vienna. You can imagine why. So, a lot of instability in the country. And there were two, I guess, fascist movements, interestingly enough, in Austria. One was a fascist slash kind of Catholic-leaning fascist movement, I guess, Franco-style, Mussolini-style, maybe, to some extent. And then there was, like, the Austrian Nazi Party, of course, supported by Germany. So not only is the left and the right fighting against each other in Austria, but you also have the two different rights fighting in Austria. By the 1930s, Austria has essentially become a dictatorship under the like Catholic fascist right. Its main opponent, actually, interestingly enough, isn't actually the left. It's the Nazi Austrian Party. So, starting around 1937, Hitler starts putting a lot of diplomatic pressure, diplomacy, on Austria to align its foreign policy more closely with those of Germany. And, of course, he encouraged and funded the Austrian Nazis to step up their subversive activities against the Austrian government, which, like as I said before, was actually another kind of fascism. Earlier, in fact, that the Austrian Nazis had actually assassinated one of the presidents, Dollfuss, I think his name was, an Austrian Catholic fascist in retaliation for something he did with respect to the parliament. But again, I diverge. So the pressure is mounting on Austria. Austria is pressured into holding a referendum as to whether or not, you know, the country should join Germany, unify with Germany, the so-called Anschluss. And this referendum takes place in April of 1938. And surprise, 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 with the help of the rigging and the ballot box stuffing on the part of the Austrian Nazis, Austria voted to unify with Germany, thus achieving Anschluss. Now, what's important for us is not that this is any kind of great diplomatic victory beating up on this small country, Austria. What's interesting for us, or what's important for us, is the response by the other countries, okay? Well, the response by the Brits and the French, who you would have expected might do something given the fact that, you know, Austria is a country that was formed as part of the outcome of the First World War. France and Britain argued that under the Treaty of Versailles, which actually only dealt with Germany, they were not obliged to defend Austria against the Germans. This is after the German president went to Britain and France and said, help. And the British and French said, no. Mind you, even if there was a treaty, I'm pretty sure the Brits and the French would have broken it. In fact, the British response was almost like, well, you know, I mean, these Austrians, they're German. So it kind of makes sense that it's kind of understandable, let's say, that the Germany would want to unify with Austria. Hitler had been selling diplomatically this reunification or unification of the German people in Central Europe, and Austria was sort of sold internationally in that light. And Britain was like, well, yeah, I mean, sure, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? The country that was a guarantor of Austria was Italy. Guarantor meaning that it's a guarantor of its independence and sovereignty and so forth. I mean, as far as Hitler is concerned, looking at Austria and looking at a possible Italian response, I mean, honestly, there was absolutely no fear on the part of Hitler that Italy might do something in response to the German Anschluss with Austria. The United States doesn't give a crap. And then finally, the Soviet Union is completely out of the picture. So this so-called second great diplomatic victory, which people often point to as one of these successes on the part of Hitler, honestly really isn't a success when there is absolutely no one there to resist what you're going to do. It's like, I mean, if we were to convert this into a schoolyard kind of thing, it's like Hitler saying, well, look at me. I'm such like this amazing, great diplomat. I beat up in the next, this tiny little country and nobody stopped me, or nobody tried to even stop me. In fact, one of the other big guys in the schoolyard actually, took my side in me bullying and beating the crap out of the little guy. Honestly, not really a great diplomatic victory here. I don't understand why people think this is a great diplomatic victory. Makes absolutely no sense to me to even begin to think about this in a way other than just some guy bullying a little country. So imagine if the world would have launched a war against Hitler right after or during Anschluss. Think about all the millions of lives that could have been saved if it wasn't for the overwhelming cowardice, I guess, on the part of the great powers who were, in a sense, responsible to make sure these kinds of things weren't going to happen after World War I. But anyways, maybe I'm getting a little too, what's the word I'm thinking of? Maybe I'm getting a little too idealistic here, that somebody could have done something. I want to make sure that everybody understands that I'm being sarcastic here. You know, what can you do when you have such awesome diplomacy on the part of Hitler? Third opportunity to do something, or I guess maybe the third example of Hitler's awesome diplomacy involved Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia comes in two parts. So just a little bit of quick background on Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia, of course, is formed at the end of the Second World War with the remnants of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and a little bit of Germany, actually a little bit of everybody. So Czechoslovakia is an extremely multicultural country, or was an extremely multicultural country. And one of Czechoslovakia borders Germany, but along the border there was a group of German diaspora in a territory called the Sudetenland. And these were Germans that had been, I guess, territories rather, that had been taken away from Germany after the end of the First World War and given to the new Czechoslovakia. So you can imagine Hitler had been pursuing a very furious propaganda campaign against Prague, against the Czechoslovak government throughout the 1930s. And in 1938, Hitler alleges that the government in Prague is persecuting the approximately 3 million Germans that are living in this territory along the German border called Sudetenland. Of course, the Sudetens have their own little mini Nazi party that's controlled by Hitler. And Hitler tells the Czech-German Nazis in Sudetenland to make a series of demands with respect to autonomy from Czechoslovakia, knowing full well that Czechoslovakia couldn't possibly accept these demands. And Czechoslovakia couldn't accept these demands for one main reason. If they gave this ethnic minority these kinds of rights with respect to autonomy, then they would have to give it to all the other minorities in Czechoslovakia, and essentially Czechoslovakia would cease to exist. Another reason is that the Czechs had built their own little tiny version of the Maginot Line inside Sudeten territory along the border with Germany. So if the region was declared autonomous, they would essentially lose that defensive concrete construction that they had built along the border with Germany. So the Czechs then go to the French. At this point, I should mention, I forgot to mention rather, that the French had an alliance with the Czechs that they had put together immediately after the end of the First World War. And you can imagine what this conversation was like. You know, the Czechs say, "We have an alliance, right, dude?" And the French response was, "Well, yeah, we do, but you know what? We're not really willing to go to war over Sudetenland." So you can probably figure out what the British response was. You know what? These people are Germans. So why don't you just give them back to Germany? In fact, the English and the French actually pressured the Czech government. You heard what I said. The French and the English actually pressured the Czech government to reach an agreement with the Germans in Sudetenland, granting them autonomy in September of 1938. But the story doesn't end there. Hitler is not satisfied. Hitler ultimately wants the Sudetens to join Germany, right? Or he wants the Sudetenland, the territory, to become part of Germany. So now he instructs the Czech Germans in Sudetenland to demand union with Germany. The Brits are freaking out because they think that, there's this French Czech alliance, and if this leads to war, obviously the French are going to go to war. The thing is that what the Brits don't know is that the French are not willing to go to war over Sudetenland. Because the Brits are like totally freaked out thinking that this is going to lead to a war between France and Germany, the British Prime Minister Chamberlain, a guy who had been profoundly impacted by the First World War, he believed that, I am kind of defending him here, and I shouldn't, but he did believe that the First World War could have been avoided if just there had been a little bit more skillful diplomacy on the part of the country, on the part of the great powers. And he also believed that the Versailles Treaty was unfair to the Germans, especially with the issue of self-determination, which actually, I must say, is actually kind of true. So in September 1938, in the middle of this crisis, Chamberlain boards a plane and goes to visit Hitler in Bavaria, I think in Berchtesgaden, that place that was built for Hitler, that retreat that was built for Hitler in Bavaria on top of a mountain, to try to reach a settlement on the Czech issue. And at this meeting, Hitler demanded the annexation of Sudetenland. Chamberlain then goes to Prague to try to convince the government in Czechoslovakia to accept the deal, and the British offer the Czechs an alliance with Britain if they're willing to give up Sudetenland to the Germans. So the Czechs reluctantly, obviously under pressure by the British, accepted this offer. Chamberlain goes back to Hitler and says, "Hey, dude, we seems like we got a deal here." And Hitler has a new set of demands. And he now says that the other minorities, such as the Hungarians and the Poles that are living within Czechoslovakia, also have the same right to autonomy or ultimately national self-determination and possibly union with Poland and Hungary and etc. So Germany mobilizes, Poland and Hungary mobilize as well for war against Czechoslovakia. And then in late September, Czechoslovakia mobilizes. In late September of 1938, Czechoslovakia mobilizes, and it looks like there's going to be another war. Hitler ordered an attack on the Czechs to begin September 30, 1938, and the British contacted, of all people, Mussolini in order to try to get him to convince Hitler to meet for one more time. And Hitler agreed to this yet another meeting with the British, and they held a conference in Munich, September of 29, 1938, and everybody was invited. Mussolini was there, the French were there, the British were there. Oh, except for the Czechs. Yes, the Czechs were not invited, and it was going to be a conference on the future of Czechoslovakia without the presence of the Czech government. And the agreement that they reached, and remember, the Czechs aren't actually there, was that Czech military forces would withdraw from Sudetenland in the first couple of weeks of October 1938, and then that territory, Sudetenland, would be occupied by German troops. And they came up with similar deals with respect to Poland and Hungary as well. And the Czech government was presented this agreement that everybody except Czechoslovakia participated in as an ultimatum on September the 30th. And they were denied. And it was presented to them by, of course, the British. And they were denied any kind of objection to the treaty. They had to except every aspect of it. I mean, Prague was essentially abandoned by its either direct allies, the French, or its indirect allies, the British. Abandoned by its allies, Prague signs the document. So this is the point at which Chamberlain goes back to London, and there's this euphoric reception of the dude at the airport, where he gets off the plane and he holds up a piece of paper that Hitler has signed, and in that paper it says that Hitler promises to be nice, and everybody promises to be nice, and Chamberlain claims that this is the proof that Hitler is a decent human being, blah, 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 blah. I ask you now, is this a German diplomatic success when you essentially have everyone ganging up on the Czechs? I don't think so. The British and the French, who were, I guess, the natural allies of the new Czechoslovak state post-World War I, abandoned the country and even forced it, even bullied the country along with the country that was bullying it in the beginning. So this is not a diplomatic victory for Hitler. This is an embarrassment, rather, for the British and for the French. Essentially let their allied country out to dry. This is not a diplomatic victory for Hitler. This is more an embarrassment for Great Britain and France, who had proven yet again that they were not willing to take on Hitler in any way for whatever he was doing. And I'm sorry, I'm just not gonna, nothing is gonna convince me to say that this is German diplomacy at its best. It's not. So at this point, and this kind of is actually really proves my point about this ridiculous claim that Hitler was this brilliant diplomat, when in fact what was really going on was that everyone was just like, for some fucking inexplicable fucking reason, either indirectly supported him like the British, or were just completely subservient to his expansionist policies. You don't have to be a good diplomat to be able to achieve what he achieved if everyone around you is just not challenging you in any way. So the really great example of this is that in a little bit later, in March of 1939, and I won't go into the details here, the remaining parts of Czechoslovakia, the parts that hadn't been taken away from that agreement, which, by the way, took place in Munich, and therefore that's why we have, the famous Munich analogy. By March of 1939, the remaining parts of Czechoslovakia were eaten up. Hitler didn't even bother to, ask or anything like that. He just knew that this was something that absolutely no one would react to. So, honestly, diplomacy wasn't a factor, or at least anything remotely appearing to be exceptional diplomacy on the part of the Nazi. Now, the most stupid thing that happened in the 1930s as far as so-called opposition to Hitler or so-called good diplomacy or effective diplomacy on the part of the Nazis was the agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union in May of 1939, where the two countries signed a document where they promised the observance of strict neutrality toward each other should either of them become involved in a war. And that was the public version of the agreement. The secret additional protocol of the agreement was that the Soviet Union and Germany were going to partition Poland between the two of them, and the Soviets would occupy Finland, Latvia, Estonia. Honestly, this is probably the most stupid agreement that has ever been signed on the part of like a leader of any freaking country in the world. And here I'm talking about Stalin. This does not demonstrate great diplomatic effort on the part of the Nazis. This just demonstrates obvious stupidity on the part of the Soviets, because Stalin knows, or should know rather, that the ultimate aim of Nazi Germany is to conquer the Soviet Union, or vast parts of the Soviet Union. Again, this is no secret. All you have to do is pick up a copy of Mein Kampf. It was available, I suppose, in any freaking bookstore, including the Soviet Union. Well, maybe not in any bookstore in the Soviet Union, but certainly I imagine that Stalin and the NKVD, and the Secret Service of the Soviet Union at that time, the precursor to the KGB, they could have gotten access to that book. And there was like this big chunk, of the book, which was called The Eastern Problem, which outlined exactly what Hitler wanted to do with the Soviets. So I have no idea. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense why the Soviets would sign this agreement. And ultimately what this agreement does is essentially guarantees that World War II will take place, because this is the agreement that gives Hitler essentially the permission to invade Poland. Now, you got to ask yourself, are we talking about awesome diplomacy here on the part of Hitler, or are we just talking about just plain stupidity on the part of the Soviets? I don't know. I don't see Hitler being a great negotiator here. I just see Stalin being a dumbass. They signed this agreement in August 23, 1939, and in August 31, just about a week after that, the Germans invaded Poland. So World War II begins. Again, it was this agreement that essentially gave Hitler the green light. So that brings us to the end of, let's say, part one of the discussion on the Nazis being these great diplomats / military strategists. In the next episode, we'll look at first part of the war, I guess, and the way I'm going to divide it is to look at the early German successes, which take place between 1939 and 1941. So that's going to be part two. And like I said in the introduction, part three is going to look at the period after 1941, end of 1941, early 1942, until the actual end of the war. So stay tuned for the next episode, or the next part of this episode of Myth Busting the Second World War. And I'm not even going to bother to ask anybody to send any comments, because none of you ever do. Embarrassing. I'm ashamed of all of you. Really. Okay. Maybe some of you. Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached high. And in the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers and I.
Fools too.